content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I should be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On this week's program, we'll continue with an exclusive book excerpt from The Cuneiform Challenge by Joshua Hammer. In the 1850s, the world's oldest writing system was a series of baffling scratches on clay. Then four fiercely competitive scholars solved the mystery. So this article is an excerpt from a book titled The Mesopotamian Riddle, An Archaeologist, a Soldier, a Clergyman, and the Race to Decipher the World's Oldest Writing by Joshua Hammer, to be published by Simon & Schuster, LLC, copyright 2025. Where we left off in the article was William Henry Fox Talbot. He sent a letter to London's Royal Asiatic Society offering to send his own translation to look at a prism, which was inscribed with 800 lines of tiny cuneiform characters. The cylinder was sent to the British Museum, and the players at hand were Rawlinson, who was an linguistic archaeologist, Hinks, who was a parson from Ireland but had a great linguistic skill, Oppert, who was a German researcher, and then Mr. Talbot, who started the competition. The Royal Asiatic Society gave each contestant about a month to translate, and now we'll pick up where the article left off. On Wednesday, May 20th, 1857, the judges gathered at the Royal Asiatic Society's townhouse on New Burlington Street. The eminences filed into the ground floor ballroom, filled with mementos collected during members' Asian travels. Indian javelins, daggers from Yemen, and a samurai sword hung on the walls. A large cabinet held Chinese amulets designed to warn off demons and bring good fortune. There were kits for smoking opium, Sanskrit scrolls, the skin of a 13-foot boa constrictor, and a giant coconut from the South Seas. A brass globe of the zodiac, crafted by the chief astronomer of Mosul in A.D. 1275, displayed 48 constellations. An Egyptian mummy had once been on exhibit, dissected by a physician for fellow members, until complaints about the quote-unquote unpleasant smell had obliged him to donate the 3,000-year-old corpse to the King's College Museum. The chairman of the committee, Henry Hart Millman, unsealed the envelopes in front of his colleagues. Another judge attested that the four translations had been made by them in different and distant places, and that the four men had not had any communication with each other. H.H. Wilson, the society's president, noted that Hinks had completed only 28 of the 54 sections in the abbreviated time he'd been given. Oppert, who working at the French government expense in London, had finished just 21. Quote, only those of Mr. Fox Talbot and Sir Henry Rawlinson are entire, end quote, Wilson added. Then the panel began to read and compare the translations. The results initially looked less than promising. Each translator had struggled with unfamiliar vocabulary and a multiplicity of potential character readings. The decipherers disagreed over the names of wild animals, cities, countries, and vassal kings. In one account of a royal hunt, Rawlinson identified prey as wild buffaloes. Hinks called them wild elephants. Talbot, at a loss, used the Akkadian word amsi, elephant. Oppert didn't answer at all. What Rawlinson called 300 fugitive heretics, Hinks referred to as 300 fugitive female slaves. Many Akkadian logograms simply confounded them. Yet, as the judges dove deeper into the translations, they were struck by the extent to which the four decipherers did agree with one another. In one paragraph, the participants named 39 countries in the same manner exactly, the judges noted. Later in the annals, the four translated an account of one of the Tiglath-Pileser I's military campaigns with striking similarity. Rawlinson. Then I went on to the country of Kamuka, which was disobedient and withheld the tribute and offerings due to Ashur, my lord, Hinks. At that time, I went to a disaffected part of Kumka, which had withheld the tribute by weight and tail belonging to Ashur, my lord, Talbot. I then advanced against Kumiki, a land of unbelievers who had refused to pay taxes and tribute unto Ashur, my lord, Obert. In these days, I went to the people of Dumka, the enemy who owed gifts and tributes to the god Ashur, my lord. The judges also critiqued the work of each decipherer. Upert produced a translation with tortured English prose and wide divergences from the others. Quote, "It is to be regretted," the panel wrote, "that Dr. Upert did not translate into French, in which language his version would have been more clear and precise," end quote. The judges looked favorably on Talbot, who had taken an interest in his seriology only a few years earlier, but they bestowed their highest accolades on Hinks and Rawlinson, who are understood to have prosecuted the study for the longest time and with the greatest assiduity. Their submissions displayed, quote-unquote, the closest coincidence, and in hundreds of cases, the two had arrived at the same conclusions. The panel's verdict was unanimous. The results were, quote-unquote, remarkable, the judges declared. Quote, there was a strong correspondence in the meaning assigned and occasionally a curious identity of expression to particular words, end quote. When Norris made the verdict public in early June, British literary journals, newspapers, and magazines endorsed the judgment and celebrated the achievement as one of the most significant scholarly breakthroughs of the 19th century. Paul Haupt, a leading scholar of ancient writing at Johns Hopkins University, later declared the result, quote, a complete triumph for the Assyriologists, end quote. Then Athenaeum, a magazine with perhaps 10,000 highly educated and influential readers, declared that the test, quote, has been now carried out in a manner which, dot, 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 ought to set the question definitively at rest, end quote. Chambers Journal, a popular weekly magazine of literature, science, and the arts, with more than 80,000 readers, concluded that cuneiform with its, quote, arrow-headed character, so inexplicable but a few years past, is, dot, 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 an unraveled mystery, end quote. The scholars' success at deciphering Akkadian enabled them to begin translating Sumerian, a completely unrelated language that used the same cuneiform symbols. The thousands of inscriptions excavated in southern Mesopotamia contain insights into Sumerian culture, customs, daily life, and literature. More than 1,000 years older than the Akkadian inscriptions from Nineveh, they laid out the entire Sumerian cosmology, beginning with Enki, the god of water and wisdom. Scholars also found land acquisition and marriage contracts, including a list of witnesses who had rolled their seals over the margin of the clay envelope. A tablet from ancient Uruk described the 12 signs of the zodiac. There were books filled with proverbs, and one prism from 1740 BC showed 8 mathematical problems, including quadratic equations used to determine the dimensions of a rectangle. And there were also narrative poems about the creation of man. In the simplest one, the god Enki fashions a human being out of clay and binds, quote, upon it the image of the gods, end quote. Perhaps the most momentous discovery came in the early 1870s, when George Smith, a 32-year-old self-taught Akkadian scholar from a working-class London family, was perusing the collection at the British Museum during a lunch break from his job at a printing press. He came across a 6-inch by 5-inch tablet from Nineveh that told a story of a king named Utanapishti. Informed by a deity that a flood will sweep over the world, the king builds a large boat and climbs inside it. Later, the boat comes to rest on a mountain, which is followed, Smith wrote, quote, by the account of the sending forth of the dove and it finding no resting place and returning, end quote. The fragment of the quote-unquote Great Flood tablet Smith translated was a copy of the original text that came to be known as the Epic of Gilgamesh. It was probably written a few hundred years before the story of Noah in Genesis, which most scholars think dates to around 1400 BC. One of the foundational myths of Western civilization, Smith found, had originated on the Mesopotamian floodplain. Smith would have little time to bask in his global celebrity. In 1876, the British Museum dispatched him on his third expedition to Nineveh, On the journey home, he fell ill with dysentery and died in Aleppo. He was 36 years old. The bad feelings between Hinks and Rawlinson didn't fade after the Royal Asiatic Society challenge. In late spring 1857, Hinks received confirmation from Talbot of what he had long suspected. Rawlinson's friends at the British Museum had been conspiring against him all along. Back in June 1854, the day after the museum terminated its contract with him, Henry Ellis, its principal librarian, wrote to Rawlinson in Baghdad to invite him to inspect Hinks's black notebooks and offering to send him copies. Later that year, William Sandys Wright Vaux, a curator of antiquities, sent Rawlinson a 12-page excerpt, translations, notes about Hinks' methodology, and commentaries on the texts. It is not known what use, if any, Rawlinson made of that material, but sharing Hinks' notebooks was with his arch rival and without his permission was a shocking breach of trust. The notebooks themselves languished on Vaux's desk until 1857, when the trustees placed them in the British Museum's manuscripts department, finally making them accessible to the public. Hinks, plagued by jaundice and other maladies as he aged, kept working until his last hours. He was sorting through ideas about the acceleration of the moon's rate of revolution, and had just sent an article about an ancient lunar eclipse to a journal in Berlin when he died suddenly at home in 1866 at age 74. His death merited just a few short notices in the British press, several of which talked about his thwarted ambitions. For decades afterward, Rawlinson was almost universally regarded as the genius who deciphered both Old Persian and Akkadian cuneiform. The war hero, diplomat, and aristocrat enjoyed the support of the British establishment, from the British Museum's Board of Trustees to Assyriologists at its elite universities. When he died in 1895 at age 84, he received a hero send-off at a packed memorial service at St. George's Church in Mayfair's Hanover Square. One scholar coined the phrase, quote, the Rawlinson method, end quote, to describe the decipherment process, omitting any mention of Hinks. A leading Assyriologist at the University of Chicago has pronounced Rawlinson the father of Assyriology, saying that Rawlinson, quote, was the first to make the discovery of an inscription of any length and importance, and dubiously, the first to translate an Assyrian inscription, end quote. In recent years, though, growing numbers of Assyriologists have changed their view. Quote, it is Hinks, and he nearly alone, who made it possible to read, once again, the memorials of the world's first civilization, end quote. Peter T. Daniels, a past president of the International Linguistic Association and an expert in ancient writing systems, said in a 1992 lecture at the bicentennial of the Irish clergyman's birth, Irving Finkel, a philologist and Assyriologist at the British Museum, calls Rawlinson a bully who stomped over Hinks and tried to deny him credit for his accomplishments. The debate over who was first given has sometimes distracted from the grandeur of what the British Assyriologist A.H. Sayce called, quote, the archaeological romance of the 19th century, end quote. In 1905, Sayce ranked the cracking of cuneiform above even Champignon and Young's decipherment of hieroglyphics. The very names of the Assyrian kings and of the gods they worshipped have been lost and forgotten, and the characters themselves were not but conventional groups of wedges, not pictures of objects and ideas like the hieroglyphs of Egypt, end quote, he wrote. Thanks to Rawlinson and Hinks, and to a lesser extent Oppert and Talbert, quote, the ancient East has risen, as it were, from the dead, with its politics and its wars, its law and its trade, its art, its industries, and its science, end quote. Sayce ended with an homage to the German high school teacher and amateur decipherer, who in 1802 looked at Aramaic-related inscriptions at the Persian necropolis of Nashki-Rustam and surmised they could be used to translate word for word old Persian texts at nearby Persepolis. Quote, and this revelation of a new world, this resurrection of a dead past, Sayce wrote, has started from a successful guess, end quote. Next, we'll move on to an article titled Canyon of the Ancestors by Alastair Lee Bitsoy. In the Arizona deserts, researchers are uncovering extraordinary details about the peoples who have inhabited the lands since antiquity. The Canyon de Chelly National Monument on the Navajo Nation in northeastern Arizona encompasses 83,000-odd acres of sandstone peaks and plateaus towering above waterways, dotted with pines, junipers, aspens, and cottonwoods. Viewed from the sky, the canyon takes the shape of a turkey's foot, fitting since wild turkeys have lived here for centuries. The area's best-known formation may be Spider Rock, a red sandstone dagger stabbing 750 feet up in the southwestern sky. But perhaps its greatest and most mysterious feature is a vast complex of 165 or more rooms, some hewn by the indigenous peoples who have lived here for more than 1,000 years, drawn by fertile soil, fed by springs and streams, abundant wild game, and natural protection from the elements. To their successors, the Navajo, or Diné, the most sacred complex is known as Siyakin, the house under the rock, a place of deep reverence for the remnants of an ancestral culture. On a hot September day, I joined a scientific mission to the site. Though I'm Diné myself, this was my first visit, and I had some trepidation because too many indigenous people say Siyakin, also known as Mummy Cave, is a holy site considered off-limits. To cross the sandy wash from the southwest requires four-wheel drive. When a truck gets stuck in the mud or the sandy soil, use a winch to tow it out. Now and then, feral horses emerge from cottonwood trees. As the road unfurled, it revealed peach orchards and cornfields ready for the harvest. Ancient native homesteads and cultural sites, including the famous White House cliff dwellings, popped into view, then receded as I moved deeper into the canyon, accompanied by Joss Ramsey, a veteran National Park Service, NPS, archaeologist. After 2 hours, Siyakin appeared around the bend, its alcoves offering tantalizing shelter from the September sun. People inhabited this land more than 4,000 years ago, but the human-made structures date to between AD 300 and 1300, when a series of native groups built and occupied a small city's worth of homes, meeting houses, and places of worship in the cliffs. Starting more than 1,000 years ago, the inhabitants adorned the walls of the complex with decorative earthen plasters in white and occasionally green. At the center of the complex is the most elevated room, which Diné and other tribes consider the holiest spot in the remarkable site. Suddenly, around the 13th century, all the inhabitants left, most likely fleeing a drought, geologists say. Through the succeeding centuries, the natural caves protected many of the constructed dwellings inside. In 1882, Colonel James Stevenson, pursuing ethnographic work on behalf of the Smithsonian Institution, led the first team of Western archaeologists to the site, where he found two sets of human remains wrapped in yucca cordage, which had been preserved through desiccation. Stevenson's team quickly dubbed the site the Mummy Cave, which is how it's still widely known. Ever since, anthropologists and archaeologists have come here to study the remarkable history contained in the caves. Yet until now, scholars had never done a full archaeological and architectural survey of the site. Siyakin remains a powerful place to many indigenous people who live in the canyon and throughout the Southwest. But in recent years, it's become clear that the canyon's natural ecosystems, like its cultural sites, are threatened by invasive species, erosion, and the impacts of changing climate. Since 2022, a group of 15 researchers and students led by Ramsey of the NPS and Angela Bass, an anthropologist at the University of New Mexico, has been surveying the entirety of Siyakin, hiking, climbing, and occasionally rappelling down the steep walls of sandstone. Using digital photography and the remote sensing method known as LIDAR, the researchers aim to map the complex for the first time, in part to determine which portions are most vulnerable to decay and therefore most in need of protection. Eventually, the team could recommend some structural stabilizing work, perhaps including the central tower complex. And by submitting these precious plasters to electron microscopy, they are learning what their composition and the people who lived within these walls centuries ago. As I approached Siyakin in a truck, accompanied by Ramsey, the research team came into view, little dots in the distance buzzing to and fro among the sacred alcoves near where Ramsey, Bass, and other researchers have pitched their makeshift tents. Their work is both hard and delicate. They climb up the canyon's walls with their backpacks full of tools and gently collect flakes of fallen plasters from the ground to study the fine finish that has preserved them. All that's left that is expressive of the people who lived here are the plasters, Bass says, pointing to the handprints and fingerprints left in those decorative touches. The plasters, Bass argued, bring us closer to these ancestors. They have a voice. Over the next 2 days, I watched the researchers work and spend time with them over meals by the camping stove, which sat among junipers and pinyons along the banks of Awash. On the third day, threats of monsoonal rains cut short my trip, and the researchers sought refuge outside the canyon, their important work interrupted by the intensifying weather of climate change, the same force that threatens these caves. Bass, whose academic background is in art history and historic preservation, was clearly excited to examine the complex's architectural and design elements in detail. She is especially fascinated by the earthen plasters, an ancient art form she's been studying for 30 years. She recalled an episode from when she was around 20 and working as an interpreter at Mesa Verde National Park in Colorado on a day when the site had no visitors. Bass sat in one of the park's ancient alcoves and watched a conservator working on a beautiful plaster that had bighorn sheep going across it, she said, and I knew then that's what I wanted to do. The decorative plasters are just one element attesting to the history of the people who lived here. Artifacts, including tools and rock art depicting hunters, antelopes, goats, and more, tell the story of the archaic people who inhabited these lands from 2500 BC to 200 BC. The baskets found throughout the cave complex, preserved all this time with the help from the dry air, remind visitors that the basket maker people built elegant, complex public spaces in these canyon walls between 200 BC and AD 750. And the ancestral Pueblo people who dwelled here between AD 750 and 1300 were also sophisticated builders. The Hopi farmed in the valley seasonally from the 1300s to the 1600s, and the Hopi and the Pueblo still maintain their ties to the site today. Since the early 1700s, the Diné people have lived in the canyon, where they farm and herd sheep and goats through the fields, sometimes sheltering herds within the ghostly complex. For the Diné, the canyon was a stronghold against the westward expansion of the U.S. government in the early and mid-1800s. Then, in the 1860s, one of the most tragic episodes in Diné history occurred here, when the American government successfully besieged the Diné right where I stood with Bass and her team. Some historians describe this siege as the defining moment in a genocidal campaign that forced thousands of Diné people to march hundreds of miles at gunpoint from their homelands here in Arizona to Huildi, or Fort Sumter, in present-day New Mexico. Along the way, hundreds died. Government forces, meanwhile, destroyed our cornfields and peach orchards and slaughtered our livestock. We refer to this forced relocation, Diné, as the Long Walk. Though around 40 families live within the limits of the monument today, for many, the displacement remains an open wound. Though the Navajo Nation government now oversees the sacred area in collaboration with the NPS, some Diné families consider the ancestral sites to be tainted ground. For those families, and indeed for me as a Diné writer, these lands are filled with spirits, not all of them benign. As a result, I did not undertake this reporting lightly. To walk on this land, and particularly to enter any rooms of the cave complex, requires extreme caution, because to enter, in essence, to disturb the home of ancient spirit energies, bring dangers. Afterward, it is wise to offer songs or prayers for safe passage. In the end, I decided that I must respect these spirits' homes, that I would not and should not climb to the holiest parts of the complex. Instead, I watched the team work from below. When I left the canyon, feeling conflicted about the whole experience, I wonder whether simply visiting had violated a sacred code. Later, somewhat shaken from my visit, I got in touch with Joseph Pablo, a Diné cultural practitioner based in Naschiti in the Navajo Nation. Pablo pointed out that even though I did not go up the heart of the site, as the researchers did each day, I did share meals with the team, and they may have exposed me to the energy of the dead. "You will get sick from it," Pablo warned me. "You will get dizzy. You will get cramps." He said it is common practice among Native peoples to avoid touching the remains of pottery at the site, or even to eat food within view of Siyakin. He added that if I spent too much time on this type of reporting, could harm my being more deeply in the future. Pablo led me through a set of healing rituals used traditionally after exposure to the dead. In the Diné language, the term hazo refers to a balanced wellness, spiritual, mental, emotional, and physical. Without Pablo, I wondered whether my Hazo would have returned. I wondered, too, what Hazo would mean in the future at this site, and whether Native groups will ever regain true control over their ancestral lands, perhaps bringing some peace to the spirits who dwell in the walls. Bass and her colleague, Douglas Porter, an architectural conservator at the University of Vermont, say they feel their own urgency to map this holy ground. Part of the work we're doing is documenting these places against the threat of loss, Porter says. Bass adds, the structures are fragile. They are especially vulnerable to wind abrasion and water running off the sheer cliffs where overhangs are eroding. Given the likely damage to Tsiyakin in the future, Porter says, the question becomes, what do we want to preserve about this site? Should something terrible happen and we lose it? Thanks to comprehensive mapping and LIDAR imaging, the physical topography will be recorded for posterity. The spirits are less easy to capture or to flee. We'll finish today's episode with a quick Ask Smithsonian. Tom Ruppel from Dixon, California asks, are humans the only species to drive another to extinction? Human activities are the most prominent cause of species extinction today, but not the only one. A recent study estimated that over half of contemporary extinctions in land vertebrates were caused, at least in part, by invasive species. The domestic cat is among the worst offenders. Its cuteness belies how devastatingly effective it is at hunting birds and small mammals. The cat's influence has been most severe on islands where native species evolved without predators and therefore have no defenses. One can assign humans some of the blame for introducing predators. However, the fossil record shows that species have been going extinct far longer than humans have been around. Some extinctions were caused by changes in the physical environment, such as the asteroid impact that killed off the dinosaurs, except for birds. However, many other species have gone extinct when nothing dramatic seemed to be happening. Some of these surely were related to the effects of predators, parasites, and competitors, though the fossil record generally doesn't give us enough information to identify the cause of a species' demise. That's Jean Hunt, curator of paleobiology at the National Museum of Natural History. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. My name is Jen Rogers, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.